Yes, thank you, Baylor. And like Andy, I'd like to thank the organisers and the opportunity to speak here and indeed to be the last speaker. There was an old phrase, tail end Charlie, which I think has wartime connotations, which is what I feel like. So Baylor suggested that I give an overview of the Osmosis project. Osmosis was a project that we ran in the UK from 2012 through till about 2017. As is traditional, it's a very contrived acronym that leads to corny jokes, so I don't think I need to say anything more about that, other than that the jokes don't improve with time. Kelvin, you'll be relieved to hear that. We managed to get together most of the main groups in physical oceanography in the UK, both the deep and the shelf sea folk. And I would like to credit my two Reading colleagues, Alan Grant and Brodie Pearson, who will contributed to the work particularly here. So, what did we do? The aim was to understand mixing in the ocean surface boundary layer, so we're at the top surface again, we're on the bottom that Andy was thinking about. And in particular, we wanted to see if we could see some of the Langmuir turbulence effects that have been talked about prior to this. That we talked about earlier in this week. In addition, we also wanted to get some observational studies of sub-mesoscale motions in this region of the ocean. So there are really two sides to the project. I will say that my expertise lies firmly on the Langmuir turbulence side, but I will try and get some of the sub-mesoscales. We've got some new results there right at the end. The observation site was just off the coast of Ireland here, so it's the PAP site, the Porcupine Abyssal Plain, which is a well-studied site for biology. And what we did was really two things. We had a long-term mooring array, so this is old-fashioned oceanography where you chuck $1.5 million worth of kit into the ocean, you come back a year later to see whether it's still there, if it's collected any data, and if the data is any good. And we also did some modern oceanography using gliders, where you chuck $100,000 worth of stuff into the thing and you get your data in real time every day, and it works pretty well. So it was kind of an interesting turning point to see that. So we had these long-term mooring arrays, and this is the shape of the array. We had a central mooring array, which was rather detailed observations in the surface boundary layer, you know, the usual kind of current, temperature, salinity, and so on. We then had a sub-mesoscale array at a diameter of about 1 kilometer. In fact, what's not shown here was we had a mesoscale array at about 10 kilometers. So in this way, we were able to compute some gradients at these different scales to try and get some of the larger scale context to the central evolution.
If I'm reading your scale right, these are 10 kilometer separation.
Yeah, okay, that's the mesoscale outer, so the inner's in there. Right in there, about a kilometer or so. Yeah, and so thank you, Jim. What I hadn't pointed out is the reason for showing this plot is the long-term gliders, we had pairs out at any one time doing these bow tie kind of patterns. So Andy brought one of his gliders along, for example. So these were rather conventional measurements over the long term, the temperature, salinity, and current. We also had a cruise early in the deployment, which focused more on turbulence measurements, so particularly dissipation in that upper layer. Really where I was going in my contribution to this project was to think about modeling and could we see signatures of Langmuir turbulence versus other more conventional types of mixing in the mixed layer. And we wanted to do that in order to develop parameterizations for global models. So this talk is rather looking towards new parameterizations for global models, and that's what I'll try and give you some hints from here. So specifically today, I'll just give you some idea of what we collected during the cruise and the mooring data. I'll then show you some modeling work that we did to look for evidence of Langmuir turbulence in the observations. I'll then give you a very schematic view of this new ocean surface boundary layer scheme that we've developed now, and I will try and canter through that rapidly enough to show you some hot off the press long-term measurements that give a hint on the sub-mesoscales. So I guess this is a proof that the mooring arrays and the gliders did yield something. So this is a year's worth of data from September 2012 through September 2013. The cruise period was right at the beginning here, and I am a desk scientist. I've never been to sea. The cruise was at this point, and the shrewd amongst you will also see that this is pretty much the exact day that I moved from Reading University to the Hadley Centre, and my duties there kept me away from the cruise. So I am still a desk-bound scientist. The good news is that David Marshall went on his first cruise then in my place, so there we are. What this is showing is a depth time profile of temperature and salinity. So we have a mixed layer, and this is the usual kind of De Boer-Montague definition of mixed layer depth, which I'll come back to later. So it's showing that we have a kind of summer mixed layer which deepens during the winter. There are kind of some interesting variations in that through the course of the winter, but basically it's a classic winter deepening. There's some pretty crazy stuff happening in here which I'm not going to talk about, therefore you will ask me about. And then there's a nice shoaling during the spring, showing heating during the calm days, and then a deepening down and a progressive shoaling of the boundary.
How much horizontal average are you doing here across your gliders?
So the glider span was some kilometres. They're piercing the mixed layer. They come up and down two or three times a day, I think, looking at Andy.
Well, that's another way of saying sort of time averaging
over. Yeah, so we're... Yeah.
This isn't a single glider.
This is a combination of two gliders, so I think we get four transects a day. Yeah, but they're separated by some small number of kilometres. No, I don't think so. We take the profiles as individual data sets. Okay, but you know, gross features, right?
Pretty close to rock profiles.
Yeah. Again, if you remind me, I'll come back to that when we get to the results. I think there's some interesting stuff there. For the cruise, this is a summary. The cruise was about 2 weeks long. We kind of lucked out here because we wanted to sample as broad a range of conditions as we could. And the first week, we had really quite calm winds. So the wind speeds here in black, measured in U-star. So this is low winds. And this is the net radiation forcing the layer. So positive is outgoing cooling during the night, and then you're seeing a strong signal of solar warming during the day. If I skip down to these plots, which is a depth time series of turbulent dissipation rate, with the warm colors indicating strong dissipation and therefore active mixing, what you can see here are some really nice diurnal cycles. It's missing here, but again, so the surface boundary layer is deepening during the night, shoaling during the day, deepening during the night, along with this. If we look in the temperature signals here, of course you don't see this because this diurnal cycle is relatively weak. However, capturing this diurnal cycle turns out to be really quite important for the restratification and the shoaling during the spring. So we think, based on this evidence and what we've done on the spring, that capturing this diurnal cycle is really a crucial part of that restratification. Having said that, those of you who haven't heard me speak before will forgive me. I have spoken about this period quite a lot in the past. So in order to get to the sub-mesoscales, I'm not going to say any more about that, although if anyone would like to talk about it, I can discuss it later. During the second week, you can see the wind speed picks up, and we had a mild storm come through. And the blue line here, if you can distinguish that from the black, is the Stokes drift at the surface. So because we're interested in Langmuir turbulence, we're interested in the waves and the Stokes drift that goes along with those waves. So you can see that on these timescales, there is something of a lag of the waves to the wind, but it's rather modest, actually. It's hours rather than days, as you'd expect. If we look at, switch down to the dissipation rates, we're getting stronger stirring. The stirring is penetrating deeper, and with the eye of faith, you can see a deepening mixed layer down here associated with that sustained mixing. The other final thing I wanted to draw your attention to here is there's a kind of interesting aside. This is temperature, and we're marking out some isopycnals or iso temperatures here. So what you can see during this mixing event is the mix layer itself, which I'll characterize as the red period, the red patch, just for the purposes of this talk to make a point, is deepening, but rather modestly. However, if I pick out this density contour here, or temperature contour here, you can see that's mixing much more. And these were picked specifically because these encapsulate the pycnocline at the base of the layer. So this is the base of the mixed layer. We then have the pycnocline and the entrainment zone of the boundary layer, which has a rather constant depth here. But with the onset of this wind forcing, actually what we're seeing is the mixed layer remaining rather constant in depth, but the pycnocline growing. And what you don't see, but if you carry on, is the mixed layer then starts catching up.
But there's no dissipation there. Are you talking about mixing or something?
Okay, like okay. Yes, that's a good point. That's associated with the color scheme here, I believe. There is some mixing, but how else is it moving? It could be lateral, I suppose. Okay, let's come back to that at the end. That's a shrewd observation. We think we need to build it in. So there, correct. There is an additional regime, I believe, that we're not thinking about. It's related to what we see in resonant wind-driven mixing that Large and Crawford saw. But the resonance is part of it. We don't necessarily have resonance here, but we do see that. So there's a kind of an interesting regime, and I'll pick up on that. Okay, so that's the cruise data. So let me say a few words about what drives mixing in the mixed layer, and this will be familiar to most of the audience, particularly having the week we just had. So the processes I'm going to think about are wind forcing at the surface, buoyancy forcing at the surface, both positive and negative, as in the observations. The wave processes we could think about, surface wave processes, are wave breaking. But Jim and Peter did some nice work showing that whilst it drives an interesting new way of coupling the atmosphere to the ocean, the effect of the wave breaking on the bulk of the mixer is probably not huge. So we're going to ignore wave breaking in what I will speak about later. What we are going to focus on is the role of the Stokes drift associated with the surface waves and the interaction of that via the Crate-Leibovitz equations, tilting and stretching vorticity from the vertical into the streamwise and driving rolls and Langmuir turbulence. Submeter scale processes, and I'll be talking about entrainment too. So the modeling tool that we've used to generate some idealized data is large eddy modeling. So this subject was kind of initiated by two really nice papers, led by Erik Skillingstad, and the other by Jim Williams with Pete and Chin Ho Moeng in JFM, which did large eddy modeling of what you might call the Crate-Leibovitz equation. So we take the Navier-Stokes equations with a wavy surface, and we average that over several wave periods, filter it over several wave periods, and see what comes out. And what Craik and Leibovitz showed in the mid-70s was that two extra terms come out. So this interaction of the Stokes drift on vorticity in the flow. So this is, remember, vorticity sticks with fluid parcels. So if you start with initially vertical vorticity, the strain associated with the Stokes drift will tilt that and stretch it into the horizontal, amplifying streamwise vorticity. So that's what this term is doing in practice. There's also an interaction with the Coriolis in a coherent rotating flow. So Craik and Leibovitz applied these equations to look for an instability in a kind of viscous setting. What these papers initiated was looking at that in a fully turbulent context. So if you like, take this viscous term, reduce it down or raise the Reynolds number, let it go fully turbulent, and what kind of turbulence does this equation set give? And how does that differ from a standard shear or buoyancy driven flow. That's kind of the game and what we're looking for in the observations. So our large eddy simulation box is a few hundred meters across. It has some depth of, 100 meters or so. We initiate with a mixed layer, a thermocline, and then a seasonal thermocline down here. We force that with a wind speed, with various buoyancy fluxes, and in fact we also took insulation. That turns out to be kind of important for the restratification problem. And then we specify a Stokes drift profile associated with the wave to drive that wave-driven part of the circulation. And each of these forcings is going to be fixed in the simulations that I'm going to show you. So in that way, we can set up some idealized data sets. From that, we can think about parameterization ideas, and then we're going to look for evidence of the characteristics of this in the data from the crews, build a parameterization and test that on the long-term mooring data. That's kind of the strategy that we've got here. So having done these simulations, we need to organize them somehow. And this is a boundary layer conference, right? And I haven't heard much talk of similarity theory. 20 years ago, it's all you would have heard about. So I thought it was worth just changing the heading of this slide to as a salute to similarity theory, because it's one of the tools that we've used to take these simulations and build it into a parameterization. And we've been really quite rigorous in the application of this. So similarity theory says, okay, what are the scaling velocity and length scales in the turbulent boundary layer you might have? And one can estimate those from the turbulent kinetic energy equation. So in this case, we have a shear production. We have a production associated with the strain in the Stokes drift. So a Stokes production, there's a buoyant production, and of course there's a transport. As a schematic, what we see in the Langmuir simulations, if the wind and waves are blowing in that direction, then, as I've said several times, the Crate-Leibovitz terms give us a tilting and stretching of vorticity into the streamwise direction. So that generates rolls in this wave-driven layer. They're turbulent, so they have a finite lifetime, and they meander, and they're chaotic, etc. But the structures, as Peter showed, in the flow are these streamwise rolls. Between rolls that are counter-rotating, we can generate a momentum jet that penetrates then down into the ocean surface boundary layer. So although the rolls have most of their action constrained to where the Stokes drift acts, because of this momentum jet, the effects of the rolls in mixing the layer can penetrate down essentially to an Ekman arrest depth, which is usually a lot deeper than the mixed layer. So this is the mechanism whereby a relatively shallow layer of just a few meters deep can affect a mixed layer that gets up to, say, 100 meters deep if necessary. Okay, and arguments like this motivate that the length scale of the turbulence in our layer is the boundary layer depth, and that carries through for wind-driven turbulence and convective turbulence. So these scalings are conventional, straight out of the literature, U star for the wind-driven and a convective scale, velocity scale for a convective boundary layer. And then in the Langmuir turbulence, one can use the TK equation to motivate the fact that because the production is U star squared multiplied by the Stokes drift, then the velocity scale kind of comes out of that. So that's what we're going to take as our scaling velocity for the Langmuir. So we can estimate the scaling of the shear production as U star cubed over H, the Stokes production of W star cubed L, this Langmuir velocity scale over H, and convective turbulence is W star cubed over H, as you conventionally do. We then have two control parameters that control where we sit between these three regimes, and they can be measured by the ratio of those terms, so the ratio of the shear production, the conventional shear production, to the Stokes production is been called the Langmuir number. So that controls where we are on standard shear turbulence versus this Langmuir turbulence. And then we can measure where we are between convective turbulence and Langmuir turbulence by taking the ratio of those two terms. And that gives us something that looks like the depth of the boundary layer to what looks like a Mononobikov type length scale that Andy introduced. But in this case, it's a Mononobikov that scales on the Langmuir velocity scale rather than U star squared. So it's kind of a Langmuir-Obukhov scale, if you like. And again, that parameter then controls where we are between pure convective turbulence on the one hand and pure Langmuir. So we've got these scaling velocities now, velocity and length scales. So with those, we can make profiles of these different types of turbulence dimensionless. And we can measure where we are in the different parameter space using these control parameters. So does it work? And here I'm thinking of number one, parameterization schemes, and number two, how I compare with the observations. So here's a profile of the turbulent dissipation rate from a range of LESs going from this Langmuir number of 1.5, so that's a pretty strongly wind force case, a relatively weakly forced wave case, going down to Langmuir numbers that are less than 0.5, which are strongly wave force cases. And the dissipation in this case is normalized, made dimensionless, using the Langmuir scaling. So the depth of the layer for Z and normalized on the Langmuir scaling for the dissipation in this direction. And what we see is for these strongly wind force cases, we're kind of out there, but as we increase the wave forcing, or if we decrease the Langmuir number, our control parameter, we begin to collapse these dissipation rates onto a single curve. So a similarity curve, right? That's why it's called similarity theory. When you make it dimensionless, it collapses onto a single profile. Now this has a couple of useful implications, actually. Firstly, the fact that it does collapse under a scaling tells us that the turbulence we're getting out of this Crake-Leibovitz equations is a type of turbulence. It's an asymptotic state, which is different from other kinds of turbulence, because it has a scaling. When we take that scaling, the profiles collapse. It could have been that the Crake-Leibovitz terms just keep pushing us away from shear turbulence, and it just keeps getting further away. It doesn't get anywhere new, but it does get somewhere new. And the fact that it converges in this way means that we can fit profiles to that, similarity profiles to that, and then we know what dissipation looks like in a Langmuir turbulence layer. So to give you some taster of that and see how it compares with observations, here's W squared, the vertical velocity variance, again normalized on this W star L squared, the scaling velocity for Langmuir, against depth. And again, the curves collapse very, very nicely, and there's much higher W squared than you get in a shear layer here. And the symbols are observations from Eric Desaro's Lagrangian float, and they line up really nicely with these LES curves. So the scaling has worked in collapsing stuff, and it's helped us compare with observations and show that this universal curve for Langmuir turbulence is kind of doing the right thing. So this provides us with some evidence that we can see Langmuir turbulence, and the Crake-Leibovitz equations are a sound theoretical basis for computing this kind of turbulence. So maybe it provides some post hoc justification for neglecting that wave breaking turbulence at the top if we're interested in the bulk layer. On the bottom here, I'm showing some plots of dissipation from the cruise during that windy period in the osmosis campaign. Again, normalized in the way here, and the green is the LES. Apologies for the slightly funky color scheme, but there you go. And again, you can see the collapse is really quite nice. So in the open ocean, it looks like dissipation and vertical velocity variance are kind of lining up quite nicely with the scaling and with the LES. However, nature has been unkind to us in this case, because this was the scaling of the dissipation based on the Langmuir scaling. The other obvious thing you do is to make it dimensionless based on standard shear turbulence, right? Which is what the right-hand curve is. And furthermore, Alan Grant used to work in atmospheric turbulence, and the blue here is an aircraft observation of dissipation in the atmospheric boundary layer. I'm told you can't fly aeroplanes through the ocean boundary layer. And when normalized in this way, they all kind of collapse Well, maybe not quite as well as that, but it's not so different. So that's a pest. And the reason it's a pest is that, well, the reason it occurs like that is that the dynamic range of Langmuir number we're observing here is modest, actually. What we'd like to see in order to really nail this collapse is a nice big dynamic range of the Langmuir number to show that the Langmuir number scaling collapses it. But it goes back to that fact that when the wind picks up, the waves don't take long to catch up. So actually the Langmuir number has a dynamic range that centers on 0.3, which is fully developed wind and waves, and it kind of wanders around that a little bit only in this data set. So there's a caution there.
Steve, presumably if you measured close enough, those red curves would shoot way to the right.
Yeah, so this is...
I mean, they would be an order of magnitude bigger than the green curves.
Yeah, that's right. I presume so. This was as close as we could measure to the surface with the, you know, some of the intricacies of the gliders. Yeah. So what do we take from this? Well, we take that the vertical velocity variance is lining up very well, and that would not, I don't have the plot here, but for shear turbulence, you'd be a factor of 5 smaller. So there's strong evidence from here that we're seeing Langmuir. This is consistent with it. But I'm being super honest and saying, you know, we have a dynamic range issue here, perhaps. Okay, so we also have evidence of the Langmuir circulation in that diurnal cycle, but as I mentioned previously, I'm going to leave that to one side in this talk, but I can discuss that later. So, I have 5 minutes left, so if I'm going to get to this sub-mesoscale, I need to go. So we've got this regime diagram now. Remember, our control parameters were the Langmuir number, going from Langmuir turbulence on the left out to shear turbulence on the right. We've got this convective parameter, again with Langmuir turbulence bottom left, going out to pure convective on the top. With the similarity theory, effectively, what we do in the parameterization is build a model for a convective boundary layer, a model for a shear-driven boundary layer, a model for a Langmuir turbulence boundary layer, and we use these control parameters to go between those different states in the parameterization. We had a paper with many members on the author list or in the audience where we looked at data from the Southern Ocean to diagnose which of these regimes we might be in, and this is the sort of PDF or the histogram of where we sit. So in this part of the Southern Ocean, at least, it doesn't matter so much whether you parameterize the wind-driven turbulence based on this pure diagnostic study. It goes between convective and Langmuir turbulence. Those are really the key processes. Okay, so I now have one slide on the scheme, then some results, and then I'll show you possibly some sub-mesoscale stuff. And I want to spend just a few minutes on this. So we've taken the best of two approaches to modeling the mixed layer. So back in the 70s, the favored model were bulk models. But then since the 90s and so on, grid point models with diffusivities and TKE models, so turbulence models, have become more popular. We've decided to, in this osmosis scheme, to try and bring the best bits of those together. So in particular, we've developed a prognostic equation for the depth of the layer. So the bulk models would have a diagnostic estimate of the depth of the layer. We've generalized that to make a prognostic equation that determines the deepening of the layer in strongly false cases and shoaling of the layer in restratification cases. Again, I can take you through the details. There's a really nice framework. You can do that using conservation of the buoyancy, the mean buoyancy, and the potential energy. So if you like, the potential energy is the heat content, and the buoyancy is like the first moment of that. Where does the heat sit? Is it at the top or the bottom? And that's what gives you access, the combination of those, to the depth. I guess the reason that we thought this was a good idea is because schematically, here's a mixed layer with a well mixed layer, an entrainment layer with a very strong density jump across it, and then a seasonal thermocline. Typically, this layer is rather shallow compared to the depth of the layer. And so in order to deepen the layer, we're really trying to compute fluxes across that deep layer. So to get a closure model to do that, you're kind of asking to get things really right in gradients and diffusivities and so on. So rather than do that, the prognostic approach is trying to parameterize the fluxes across that layer as a discontinuity using similarity theory. So this is the equation that deepens the layer. And then embedded within that, we develop a first order closure, which is going to look something like KPP, or does look something like KPP, to give you diffusivities and profiles within this layer. The final motivation for this approach, you'll remember at the start when I showed the cruise data, in the wind force case, it looked like there was this period where the mixed layer itself was not deepening too much, but the Pickner climb was deepening more rapidly. And so we've got some simulations that show this behavior. And I'm sure you can see already that rather than just having one box, we can now make a two-box model. So it gives us that flexibility, again, to really control the way the bulk properties of the layer are evolving. So that's really was the final motivation for this approach. Okay, I think I'll leave that. So here are some results. So this is comparison now with the long-term glider data, and which was written up by Gillian Damerol and the folk at UEA. So I'm showing here as an example the restratification going through from April to September. The dots are the mixed layer estimated from the gliders. And going back to Jim's question earlier about were these raw profiles, you can see that we're getting about 4 estimates of the mixed layer depth per day. So this is pretty rich in data. The model, of course, is predicting some kind of mean depth, and the way it restratifies, I think we're pretty comfortable with. I think that's reasonably good performance, and we've compared it with other models, and it does okay, actually. And the profiles in the interiors, this is rather than individual profiles, we've taken a range. I think, it's going to be in this period here, I believe. So the blue dots are the range from the observations and the red from the model. So we're getting the depth really quite nice and the structure. Below here, of course, is initialization things. So again, just going back to Jim's point, one of the things we've been wondering is whether there is obviously some scatter in the estimates from the glider of the mixed layer depth. What's the information in that? Because this is a turbulent flow. The interface between the surface boundary layer and the flow below is an inhomogeneous time-varying surface, as Peter's large eddy simulations of atmospheric convective boundary layers have shown us. So are we seeing actual information in this? And I don't have an answer to that, but I think there's an interesting question there. We looked at some of your scalings based on the Richards number, and that's not the whole story here, just to anticipate a question. Okay, so I've taken you through a very rapid canter. I'm going to end now. So this is hot off the press, and therefore is a 6-panel, slightly daunting looking set of plots. So what we've been able to do, so Tom Rippeth had this very neat way of taking the ADCP measurements near the surface and backing out a dissipation measurement. So at one level, which is roughly 50 meters below the surface, we've got a time series of dissipation going through December through to late spring, April, and so on. So what can we say about that time series? And are there signatures of sub-mesoscales? This is my penultimate slide now. So again, lots of scatter, but it's dissipation, and there are averaging time issues, et cetera, et cetera. So that's probably sampling errors there as much as anything else. Using the similarity theory, you remember I showed you those collapsed profiles of dissipation due to the Langmuir. We can make a fit to that. We know the Langmuir number, so we can use that from the theory we've developed here to get a theoretical estimate of a surface force dissipation. And that's that one. And so you can see the wiggly line associated with the wave-forced Langmuir turbulence actually explains a huge amount of that time series. Straight convective turbulence has moments, but generally it's a factor of 2 or 3 smaller in this data set. And then my final comment, and I defer to experts on this is not my area of expertise, we estimated dissipation due to two possible sub-mesoscale processes. So one is the slantwise convection, and the other is the Ekman buoyancy forcing that's been talked about. And the punchline is that in this data set, we do see plenty of lateral fronts. I don't have that slide here, but again, I can show that. And you can see there are certainly plenty of episodes when there is the theory or the scaling would suggest there is a contribution from either of those processes. With the exception of this one event here and maybe one here, in this part of the ocean, at this time of the year, the sub-mesoscales look like they're a second-order contribution to turbulent dissipation. So a conversation I would like to have at some point is dissipation a good measure of whether or not the sub-mesoscales are having an active role in other aspects of the surface boundary layer, such as the depth and so on. Okay, so I think having run a few minutes over time, let me just conclude. So I gave you a quick tour of the observations at the osmosis site. So there was the detailed period where we tried to measure characteristics of the turbulence, and the goal there was to see if we could see these differences that we expect from normal standard boundary layers that are special to the ocean, and we saw some evidence of that. We then took a year-long data set through the mooring data and the gliders, and that provides a data set to compare models and parameterizations. So one of the great bits of work that's been done in this program already with Ching and others is to, I'm looking, I can't see him, is to develop some data sets to compare that. We think we've seen some evidence of Langmuir turbulence. It is slightly more difficult to get out than you'd like it to be because of this dynamic range issue, but I think there's enough accumulated evidence now to be pretty clear-cut, actually. I gave a hint at the scheme, and then I gave you some view on sub-mesoscales, so I'll end it there. Thank you.
So I'm curious about number three. I'm assuming that the scheme is adjusted for the osmosis site, and therefore it's supposed to look good there. But I'm wondering if you actually tried it somewhere else where you hadn't adjusted it for.
Okay. Thank you for the pejorative way that you've phrased that question, Dimitri. So. I mean, I'm being cheeky. The depth scheme is a reasonably straightforward set of equations. For the deepening layer, it's an entrainment type thing, and for the stably stratified. I show this because the number of coefficients in the prognostic equation for the depth is small. It's like three coefficients. We get those from the large eddy model, and we just take that model and dump it directly in the ocean. There's no tweaking. So
the osmosis site is
yes. Yeah.
It's an out of sample.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Thank you.
Going back to the turbulence in the blue temperature region as opposed to the red temperature region, it was difficult to see how high your dissipation rates were and whether or not there was a change in those two conditions.
Yeah.
But I'll make comment that in the tropical ocean, we see plenty of examples.
Yeah.
We see it practically all the time, where mixing caused by inertial gravity waves, inertial instability, parametric subharmonic instability, perhaps, is producing elevated values, elevated levels of turbulence below the mixed layer and down to the thermocline.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to look at that.
Yeah, I totally agree. So so we stumbled across this regime actually when we first got started in this problem. We tried to mimic some of Jim and Peter's simulations, and we got the initial depth of the layer wrong. We made it too shallow, and we saw this weird behavior where the mixed layer was basically constant in depth and the pycnocline just kept growing. And then we put the right depth in and we saw what they saw. And you're right, on the equator where F equals zero, it's just a kind of shear driven layer with no Coriolis. And for relatively shallow layers, and the parameter looks like, I'm not going to say that, the peak decline is the bit that grows in the larger dissimulation. I don't believe I've got plots of that in this slide deck, but I'm agreeing with you. I think the equator is a region where this seems particularly important. In mid-latitudes, my final comment is FH of U star looks like the key parameter. So it's like an Ekman depth thing. And what you need is the Reynolds stress to be non-zero at the base of the peak decline so that that can do work on the turbulence in the shear layer below. That seems to be the mechanism that we have. Kelvin, I think you're thinking of stuff coming up from the bottom.
No, I think you're agreeing with me for the wrong reason.
Good.
In that the processes I was talking about would not be in your LES model.
Because they come up from below.
A lot of it is wind-generated inertial gravity waves.
Right.
Propagating through the thermocline.
So we agree to disagree on this. Maybe there are two mechanisms to drive this behavior.
I had a question. I know Jim's got his hand up there too. So I have one off-base question and one that's kind of ignorant. I'll start with the ignorant one.
Okay.
Just trying to put this together. What you started with the observations, and you showed this region after a storm where there's enhanced mixing below the mix layer, and then you proceeded to include Langmuir turbulence in your parameterization.
Yep.
And I'm a little confused by the jump. What evidence was there that it was actually Langmuir had anything to do with this excess, or is that now what you're implying? And the other one's way off base. I'm wondering in a parameterization like this, I know that one of the most difficult places for the mixed layer parameterization to get things right is the Bay of Bengal.
Yep.
Which probably requires lateral fronts from sharp gradients, and I'm wondering whether this scheme helps that at all or not.
I can answer the second point straightforwardly. We have not tried to do that. And of course, this is a 1D scheme. So if lateral fluxes are important or lateral instabilities, then clearly we're not going to handle that. And it was one of the reasons to be thinking about the submeter scales. Your point about my jump, I didn't take you through that carefully enough. The mixing below the mix layer that we saw in the data was really an aside that something possibly unusual was happening there. I then jumped and said, when we've got wind forcing, let's kind of ignore that peak decline thickening for now, because it doesn't always happen. When we've got wind-driven mixing, we've always got waves, so let's think about the Langmuir turbulence and see what the evidence for that is. And the evidence we saw were from Eric DeSaro's W-squared profiles, and then from some of these measurements of the dissipation profile. I hope that helps.
So back to this mixing question mark. Now that you've given the talk, how does your parameterization deal with that interval?
So it looks like the Reynolds stress is a roughly linear profile, right, in this kind of layer. So it starts at the value you've got at the top of the layer associated with the wind forcing, and then it reduces with depth. In these layers, in the large eddy modeling, in the case we're considering, there is a non-zero fraction of the Reynolds stress at the base of this shear layer. So you just get standard shear production of turbulence there because you've got some Reynolds stress going down there. Hence FH of U star is the parameter. Having got that production of turbulence, one can then build a box model for that layer average turbulence, and one can generate entrainment fluxes. So that's a kind of schematic of how it's built.
Schematically, that sounds fine. Have you applied your osmosis scheme to that week? And how did it do in that expanding, deeply stratified layer?
I've made a rod for my own back here. I shouldn't have drawn attention to that. So the answer is yes, we have applied the prognostic depth schemes, the osmosis data. Here I'm going to risk confusing people. So these are now showing the dissipation rate measurements. And this is the windy period. So it's kind of Kelvin's point of, was there much evidence of dissipation below the mixed layer? Well, if you ignore that, then this prognostic box model, which ignores this deepening of the pycnocline, does pretty well. But I think there is some other physics hiding there that we're not currently capturing.
If you had plotted here the isopycnals, how would it look?
The mixed layer depth would track that pretty closely. So that red stuff, and then the
isopycnals below the mixed layer.
Yeah, right. They would be moving down here. So this model would produce a pycnocline that's about 10% of the depth of the layer, because that's what we build into the standard version of the model. But the data are saying it should grow to being about 25-30%.
So the answer is no. Thank you.
I'm not gonna stand for that. what it does model is this part, but it certainly does not model that the evolution of that structure at the moment. But I think we're on that. We're pretty close.
Stephen.
Luigi.
To comment, can expect this about waves.
Yeah.
And you just mentioned Reynolds stress right now. And about the depth of the mixed layer, at the beginning you mentioned that the wave mix was in the mixing due to breakers.
Yes.
However, there have been suggestions in 10 years ago that turbulence due to the unstable orbital motion could mix to much deeper depths. That could be one of the situations to take into consideration. And then I have practically a question, not to myself, about Langmuir circulation. I have a lot of experience at sea, although not on these depths, much of what, but I've seen a lot of Langmuir circulation, but always only in mild condition. All the beautiful pictures you see are in mild condition. I really wonder, is the Langmuir circulation, I don't have any physical perception of what I'm asking, is the process strong and robust enough to stand the mess that is up to 60, 80 meter depths when there is a strong storm?
So, let me go back to my opening slide. In the background is a photograph that Steve Mollysmith took some time ago. So this is looking down on Lake Ontario or Erie, one of the Canadian lakes, as he flew over it, and you can see. Is it? Okay, thank you. Everyone's seen this photo. That's so you see the wind is blowing, I think, top to bottom. I'm going to look at you. Okay. You can see, I think, the shadows and the waves propagating in that direction, and you can see the rolls. Yeah. In this particular case, and I think this is relatively shallow water, the rolls look really quite uniform, and that's probably because they're constrained by the bottom. The argument is not... We don't talk in this about Langmuir circulations because that implies a steady state coherence, mm-hmm. which we know is not visible in the large eddy simulations of the turbulent flow. It's more that the structures are elongated in the streamwise direction and interact in these pairs. So Peter and Jim's paper showed this very conclusively, I think, and you may want to add to what I've said.
That's why I was thinking of other things that you could measure, but whenever I mention them, you say, well, we can't measure that. It would be neat if you could measure horizontal variances close to the top of the water, because then you should see, like, really, really interesting V-squareds. Okay, the other thing is, can you measure a buoyancy flux sometime, some way? Because it's not only a real signature of the flow, but it's something the model really wants.
Yeah. I'm going to defer to the observational scientist in the room. I don't think it's possible to measure a turbulent buoyancy flux in the ocean. Do you have any views on this, Andy? He looks worried, for those of you at the back. It's hard.
Just photographs I have seen from, you know, the wheelhouse of ships in enormous seas, particularly when the ship pitches forward and you get a view of the wave field in front under enormously big and tortuous waves, you see bubble lines aligned with them. And I think Langmuir circulations are, you know, in whatever distorted and deformed way, are there under very extreme conditions.
I think there's kind of a theoretical reason why you might expect that. And it was, you opened this discussion in your 97 paper, Jim, that if you take isotropic turbulence and deform it by shear, you get something that looks like shear turbulence. If you deform it by a Stokes drift, which is an irritational deformation, you get something that looks, has all the characteristics of Langmuir turbulence. So there's a real robustness to the mechanism that the vertical vorticity is tilted and stretched into the streamwise direction, and the violence of the background conditions really tells you how coherent that can remain, maybe in some loose way. I have some photos, Luigi. I'll dig them out and show you them later if you're interested. Okay.
And I would just add that. So Eric DeSaro's vertical velocity float is another way of accessing it. And the way he describes Langmuir turbulence is if there is an excess in vertical velocity statistics, which is consistent with the scalings that are coming from the LES, then it is Langmuir turbulence, whether or not you can recognize the structures of the surface. And so there is about a factor of 2 scale up in W squared, kind of that, and it is observable as long as you have a big dynamic range of Langmuir number, which isn't in this osmosis data set, but Eric's gone around the world looking at different places and behind bridges and in front of headlands and things where he can vary that parameter. And in that data set, it's fairly clear that there is a Langmuir number related enhancement of vertical velocities, which seems to be the right way to think about it.
You're a co-author. Is this allowed?
No, 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 not allowed.
Only if it's critical.
Your last slide with the dissipation measurements, these are all at 50 meters. And in the winter, the mix layered up with 200 to 400 meters. So what about the role of submesoscales for deeper mixing? Or have you thought about what the vertical structure of some of these different terms would look like?
Okay, so you've got several questions there. The reason that we pick out this bit of the data set is because this is the period when the measurement is within the mix layer. Kind of obvious, right? You say we only have the one observation at that one depth at the moment, so we are limited by that. As a result, no, we have not looked at vertical structure, I think is the short answer. But I'd be keen to hear of ways that we might do that.
While you have this slide up. So I guess one comment I would make about this is one of the beautiful things about TKE dissipation is that it's exquisitely sensitive to the small scale stuff.
Yeah.
Which is also why it's not showing much signal from submesoscale. I think that's essentially, you would not predict a large TKE from the submesoscale except for under sort of extreme circumstances like the Curcio front experiment.
Right. So apologies, the lead author is in the room. There was a nice paper where again Eric DeSario showed some observations. I don't know if it was Leaf who led this one. Under the Gulf Stream, which these Ekman buoyancy flux terms certainly did poke out from above by a factor of 5 or 10, I think. So,
All right. So,
the end.
I realize that several of you will not be back after the tea break. You've made the arrangements to get to the airport, whatever. I just wanted to alert you, I will be in contact with you because probably by email. I have a specific proposal and I need your assistance. And the proposal is simply to get the public more interested in science. And so the proposal is next year will be 50 years since the first picture of planet Earth from the moon. It's an event worth celebrating. I propose we start at the equinox on the 21st of September, continue at through the next equinox, which will cover the solstice,
And we, I'm hoping we can get a local museum in each of your towns to participate. A local museum by itself is not nearly as interesting as a museum teaming up with one elsewhere in a region with a very different climate. And the third thing I would like to emphasize is that the effort should be bottom up, that we have quite a few top down efforts, and they need as a complement a bottom up one. So I'm hoping we'll discuss that after the tea break.
All right, everybody, let's have some coffee.